Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
For a long time, one of many, 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 many voices have been suggesting, my view, we should be taking cell phones out of classrooms. And I know there were rules around cell phones, but I always hear from teachers, though, that it's trickier than it's been made to be, and there still are. Well, the Ontario government says it is now going to do this, that it is going to get cell phones, for the most part, for some age groups completely, I guess, and for others largely out of classrooms. I think this is a good idea, but I'm not the education expert. Someone who is an expert in the field of education, someone we love having on this show, her name is Annie Kidder. She's Executive Director of People for Education. Joins us now. Annie, how are you today?
I'm pretty good. Thank you very much. I'm going to go to the baseball game, so I'm excited.
There you go. Well, I was down. Have you been down for the new stadium yet? It's lovely down there.
Oh, no, I haven't.
They've done a very lovely job. If they could fix the team, it would be even better, but the stadium is lovely.
Better than the Leafs. I know that's not what you're talking about.
Oh, Annie, how to bring this discussion down.
I'm sorry.
This idea of getting cell phones out of classrooms. Now, again, I'm not the expert, but I look at this and I think it just makes so much sense because I can only remember what I was like as a kid, and I would have been hopeless if I had this technology in my hands. Am I missing something, or is this a good thing?
No, it is a good thing. I mean, this is, like everything else, the devil is and will be in the details. But I think for all of us, I mean, I don't know about you, maybe you're incredibly disciplined, but I think our whole society has a problem with our phones and with our addiction to our phones. And it's especially for kids. It's been a huge change in a very short period of time where, you know, nearly all kids after a certain age have phones and they're on them all the time, as are most adults.
Yeah, no, and I've heard in the last day or so numerous yeah buts with this. Well, what about people who are English as a second language who need to take a picture of the chalkboard to be able to go home? What about if there is an emergency and they need to call home? There's been a million, just two of them. To me, though, it seems as though there's always an exception to be made, but broadly, this is something that is going to help.
And also, I think that it allows for exceptions. So with the permission of the teacher, you know, and I do think, and again, I'm an old fogey. You go, well, wonder what we did before there were cell phones, which wasn't that long ago. So I think that, you know, yes, there are the yeah buts, but for the most part, it has been a huge problem in terms of learning, in terms of distraction in classrooms, that kids have been on their phones. So there was already policy saying you weren't allowed to have your phone in class. I think that this is going to give it a bit more teeth. There are going to be consequences. It says teachers will be allowed to confiscate your phone, and also your parents will hear. It will be on your report card. So there's a sense that there will be consequences. Now, there's definitely more to be done in and around all of the issues that, you know, aren't necessarily directly connected to cell phones, but this is a step.
Do we have any idea? I know that there are some other jurisdictions that have done this. Quebec, I believe, has already started this. I know there's some in the States. Do we have any idea from the ones that have tried this already whether it works?
Well, I think that, you know, it does seem as if it works to a certain extent. I mean, there are in some places, I just read a big international study. It said that kids in schools where phones were banned during the day were then more likely to be on the phone for longer during the rest of the day after school. So that's worrying. There's still the addiction problem and still the social media problem. But it does seem as if it makes a difference. And, you know, right now we survey all the schools in Ontario every year, and they're reporting a huge amount of stress and concern over the kind of mental health of kids, over their, you know, behavioral issues. So this is one thing, and it's just one of many that can be done that does seem to make somewhat of a difference. And, you know, and it seems as if, for the most part, when kids know there's a consequence, you know, I'm sure they'll try and get around it. They are young and, you know.
We were all there.
We were all there, exactly. But what this does is it kind of announces, nope, in schools, elementary schools, as you said, all phones have to be out of sight and on silent. And grade 7 to 12, you can turn them on in the breaks and at lunch and before and after school, but not in the classroom. So it's made it very, very clear.
Well, and hopefully the one thing this does, because one thing we hear from teachers who are willing to talk about this occasionally, you probably hear this too, is that they will say, I've heard from teachers who will say, I don't necessarily feel like I'm being backed if I have to discipline a kid.
Yeah.
Because if now the rule is we have your back if you confiscate a phone, I think that's just one first huge step that the teachers believe they can do this.
Yeah, I think I really, really agree with that. I mean, I think that the one, you know, my yeah but in all of this is that it has been an issue for a long time. We did, you know, try to make policy like 5 years ago. I think it would have been good and helpful to not suddenly announce this on the weekend, but to have made sure that there was, you know, we've been calling for a task force since the beginning of the pandemic to look at a wide range of issues in schools so that everybody would have been already sort of on the same page. Teachers could have helped, you know, work out any kind of wrinkles that might exist in this new policy. And it would have been good, I think, to do more consultation. The Toronto board, other boards had already announced they were consulting on cell phone policy. So that would have been helpful. But again, I think it's a start, and it is, you know, one of the many, many stresses on schools and on kids right now.
One other thing that you mentioned, and I think this is such an interesting part of this, is we came through COVID, and one of the main concerns and things we heard was kids had mental health issues because they weren't around friends. They had no interpersonal relationships. It was all either by Zoom or by text. So I'm also wondering if now that you are going to force kids, at least for some period of time in the day, to have those interpersonal relationships again, if this flips that problem a little bit and we're almost forcing you to be personal as opposed to impersonal.
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, I read this great quote on the weekend from a social psychologist named Jonathan Haidt that said that kids these days are overprotected in real life and underprotected in virtual life. And by which he meant there are huge problems with kids just living in social media. So, but it's not enough to just go, okay, you can't be on your phone, because we have to really think about how we're teaching kids the skills and the kind of capabilities they need to, you know, build those relationships and to understand, you know, a thing, how to collaborate and how to get along with people you don't necessarily agree with. I mean, look at the world right now and how polarized it is, and how to be able to express your feelings, understand your feelings, other people's feelings, because we are in a mental health crisis, and just turning off cell phones is not going to deal with all of that. It may be a small step, but we've really got to make sure that we have a lot more support and a lot of real system change in schools to make sure that kids, that we're educating kids to be healthy rather than just dealing with the kind of crisis at the end. We've got to be working farther upstream on that.
That is Annie Kidder. She is the executive director of People for Education. You will see her if you scan the stands at the Blue Jays game today. She'll be the one not on her phone. She'll be watching
absolutely
the game.
Not. Yeah.
Really appreciate you doing thank this today. You. Thanks so much.
Okay, thanks a lot. Okay, bye-bye.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
We have someone in studio here who is surprisingly looking fresh and not like he had a long celebratory weekend, although I'm sure he did. His name is Don Robertson. He's here every Monday, but he's not here every Monday after winning his second consecutive Allen Cup. There you go. All right, little of that, because I don't know if they played that in the arena or not the other day, but they probably did. I didn't hear it.
As soon as the buzzer went.
Is that right?
Always instructions if the right guys win.
There you go. So congratulations. 2 years in a row. First time that's been done for the Allen Cup. Now, for people who don't know what the Allen Cup is, and there will be some, it's for the champions of senior hockey in Canada, and it has not been done back-to-back since the 90s, but that was an American team that got some sort of papal dispensation to play for a few years. First time a Canadian has gone back-to-back since the early 80s. So, well done.
Thank you. We won undefeated.
Yep.
And the key to our success, I think, this year was attendance by the players. We always try and build a team that is capable of winning a national championship. And having them all available for the week has always been a challenge. Now, that said, the group we had was outstanding. Last year, we didn't sit any players out. This year, we had extras and didn't get some guys in the lineup, and that's disappointing because they participated all year. But we also played without Sean Bentonovli, who spent some time with the Islanders, and he was out. He's ill. And Jason Williams, who won a Stanley Cup in Detroit, injured his back the week before the tournament. And last year's MVP goaltender, Mike Mohl, got hurt in our last playoff game and couldn't play. So we had three guys that were key ingredients and were still able to go through the tournament undefeated. So it's a bit of a grind. And I had so many people come up and said, you know, we feel so bad for Newfoundland. They played last night, Friday night, in the semifinal, and then had to play at 3 o'clock. And they're bemoaning the fact that they were tired. I mean, they're a much younger team than us. And I reminded them all that last year we played our fifth game in 6 days. We also played Friday night and won it on Saturday afternoon. So,
well, something that I was there on the weekend, and I'll say this, something that I had not seen in senior hockey in a while was – you guys didn't just skate with them and do well. You pounded the crap out of them. By the end of the second period, they looked like, and maybe it was because they were tired, but you don't see it as often in senior hockey because guys have other jobs and everything. By the end of the second period, they looked like they just wished the clock could have spun ahead and they were done. It did.
We talked about it before the game. I mean, Ron Bernacki did a great job getting the guys ready to go, and they did, surprisingly. It's always nice when they do what we asked them to do, but they did this time and said if they want to play physical, then we will pound the snot out of them. And if they don't, we'll just skate with them. It didn't matter to us. We could play any game we wanted. We had a pretty heavy team. You know, we had guys capable of making people pay a price if they acted up. And they come out full of energy and started hitting us. So you could just see it on the bench. All right. So for about the next 8 shifts, we just
it was
pounded them, and
It was not typical senior hockey because, as I say, a lot of the guys, they have families, they have jobs, they don't. That's not what they do. This was old time hockey. This was the guys going back to their younger days playing wherever they played.
It was, but they also realized that they've got about 6 months off, and they're playing for a national championship. I mean, our team, we played hard against the West as well. I mean, they tried to get physical, and we fed them a little bit, and that didn't go well with them. So we beat them. So we could play any way you wanted to play, and it was successful. And in the first period, you know, we were up 2-0, but we killed off 3 penalties in the first period,
mm-hmm.
and had one power play all day, and we only needed 19 seconds of it because we scored. So if you were going to draft this thing out and say this is exactly how you want to play for an Allen Cup, the script came to fruition.
Well, and sitting right beside you here in the studio, now obviously this is radio. I wish people could see it. I posted something on Twitter a moment ago, or X if they want to go look it up. But you have brought in the Allen Cup, and I'll tell you, I was lifting it into the studio, not overhead. I would not, you don't do that unless you win it. But it's you're going to have a workout carrying this thing around. It's a heavy trophy.
Well, I'm not. I walked into the lobby, and we're on the second floor, and I says, here, if you want this upstairs, you take it.
Scott says,
is it heavy? I said, no, it's not bad, and he grabbed it and looked at me. By the time you get to the top of the stairs and into the studio, it's a bit of a haul, so it won't be as bad for you going back down.
Well, I have no idea if the Stanley Cup is as heavy as that, but I'm guessing maybe not even, because this one, the Stanley Cup is hollow.
Yeah.
This one, the base is, I don't know, a foot high and a foot in diameter, and it's wood, and then you've got the giant goblet on top of that. This is a big, substantial trophy that I'm quite frankly nobody dropped during your celebrations.
I'm not sure what it's worth, but it's silver. Sir Montague Allen had a silver cup made, and for those that haven't heard me tell the story, The championship started in 1891, where senior teams across the Commonwealth competed for the Stanley Cup. And the people that started the Canadian Amateur Hockey Association got annoyed because they'd heard some of the teams, Toronto, Montreal, were starting to pay their players, and they wanted it to be a strictly amateur championship. And we compensate our guys for their gas, but that's it. We don't pay them to play. And, you know, you've got Chris Campoli with over 400 games in the NHL. He plays because he wants to, and his son Max is at all the games, and his dad Gino stands up behind the bench. I mean, it really is cool. You saw all the players getting their pictures taken with their families with it. But I digress. So basically the teams that were competing for the Stanley Cup were hoofed out of the league and said, if you want to have a pro league, have one. And they said, all right, but we're taking the Stanley Cup with us. So then we had to, I was born the year it was first started in 1908. But we needed a cup. And Lord Grey said, I'll get one commissioned and build it, because it was the most prestigious championship in the Commonwealth at the time. And Sir Montague Allen, an industrialist out of Montreal, said, well, I already have one. You can compete for this. So we now compete for the Allen Cup, and that football league plays for the Grey Cup, which carries a little more cachet.
Well, you know what's amazing about this, though, sitting here looking at it, is I just had to look up the dates to remind myself. This trophy is 4 years older than Titanic, which is, you know, it's an old piece of silver, and it still looks pretty good.
Been around a long time. I've been lucky enough to win it four times, so... It's hard to win three in a row, and based on the reaction in the dressing room after the game, most of the guys seem on to going to Alberta next year to try and make it three in a row. And if we can take this team, then we got to get out of our own league. And I mean, it was pointed out to me that we haven't won the league championship the last 2 years, and I pointed out that we have the luxury of resting players that are injured. And if somebody thinks that senior hockey and the Dundas Real McCoys and the Stony Creek Tigers don't play in a competitive league, didn't walk through the dressing room after every game and see the number of ice packs on guys. Some players getting frozen before the game so that they could play through the pain. Well, the pain was gone because they were frozen. But the price these guys pay to play is enormous. And it also helps, and you've heard me say it a number of times, Jacques Demers used to say, the better Patrick Waugh play, the better I coach. And last year, Mike Moll was the MVP of the Allen Cup. And this year, Ryan DeMello, who played every minute for us, was the MVP of the Allen
Goalie.
Cup.
Goalie, yeah, replacing him. You know, and you mentioned about the ice bags and the pain and playing through stuff. The irony is not just your players. I was talking with your trainer, Jen,
yeah,
who was on the bench. And I guess you got out of the way of a puck that was fired into the bench. And when you moved... You allowed it to go in a direct line right into her forehead. She took a wallop.
Yeah. I guess I failed the test of taking one for the team. I mean, it was going. It was a guy from Newfoundland just turned and fired it into our bench, and I got hard to believe I could move this big melon quick enough, but I just got out of the way. And I went, I wonder where that went. And I turned around, and she's dropping down, like, to a squat position. I'm going, that had to hurt. So she got, I think, ended up getting redone and got 12 stitches. Dr. Alan Greenspoon was there, and he came in and stitched her up originally. But she came back to the bench, and she finished the bench, and she finished the tournament with a couple black eyes. And I just said, it's playoff hockey. You look great.
Yeah, well, if your trainer is the one looking roughest of anybody on the team, it's been an interest. She was, when I talked to her, I said, it's really impolite to say to, you know, and maybe we're at a point now where this is sexist even to say, I don't know, but it's really impolite to say to a woman, is this the worst you've ever looked?
Yeah.
But it had to be about the worst she's ever looked, because it was a shot.
Probably the worst she ever felt. She ended up with a slight concussion, but she donned a hat and finished the tournament.
See, now, I would have thought you would have made her do like the organist in Slapshot and wear a helmet on the bench for the ref with a full cage as trainer.
A couple of the players were chirping pretty good for Tuna to go get her a visor. But she didn't. She just, ball cap would do it.
So what was, after the game, what was placed into this thing? What was being consumed out of the Allen Cup on Saturday?
I think a lot of tea. We're big on tea.
Tea, yeah.
I think we had champagne available for the winning team, and there was some of that going on. I ended up going up to see our executive, which is the best team in Canada. Our volunteer group is just second to absolutely none in Canada. And we estimate there was over 3,000 volunteer hours invested in the event. And so I spent some time with them and come back, and they were drinking something out of it. It was probably a combination of beer and champagne and everything else, and they were bugging Bernie and Tuna and I to go with them. Off, they went off to Sean and Ed's to start with, and they ended up in a pub in downtown Hamilton and apparently swung through Hess Village and bugging me to go. But I'd put in about 90 hours that week, and I was sound asleep in bed at 9:30. I can't do it anymore. As much as the heart would love it to, the brain is won over the heart. And Susan and I headed home, and the Leaf game put me to sleep.
Yeah, they would do that. Yes, it would, you probably had to ruin a good Saturday night by watching the Leafs. We'll get to that in a minute. But so you're the guy who, in a lot of ways, has kept senior hockey alive. You bankrolled this thing. Do you? I know you're thrilled that you won. Do you come close to making, to breaking even on this thing, or are you just paying for this because you love it?
The plan was this year that we could make up some losses, but sadly, we changed the dates of the tournament. Last year, we sat there at the GM's meeting on Sunday morning, I guess it would have been, and I said, I fashion myself as being fairly clever, but the NHL stopped on Thursday and doesn't start till we open our first game. And traditionally, Hockey Canada, when they ran the event, they start all their tournaments on the Monday and conclude them at the end of the week. So we made a decision collectively as a committee to start the tournament on Saturday night so we get Saturday, Sunday, and not have competition with the NHL. And the NHL, in their infinite wisdom, decided end it Thursday and start it Saturday. So they had one. There was one NHL playoff game last Saturday, a week ago Saturday. It was the Toronto Maple Leafs against us. So we played Monday, Wednesday, Saturday, Monday, Wednesday, all against Leaf games. And so the chance to make up for last year's office or losses kind of got sidetracked with the Toronto Maple Leafs. And you can judge for yourself if they're worthy of watching right now, which again is something I'm sure we're going to talk about. But it's different. You know, it doesn't matter because Ryan Dodd from Innisfil, and it looks like they're going to host the event next year in Innisfil, Alberta, and they've been troopers. They've been here 2 years in a row. I predicted they'd have the best team in the tournament, and they didn't win a game, so my projections aren't particularly good. But he came up to me during the semifinal and said, looked me in the eye, and he said, it's worked. You said if we bring it back, we can make it work, and he thinks they're going to add four teams next year, and Newfoundland are talking about splitting their league and half of them being AAA because we've kind of made a rule house rule that you have to be a AAA league to host it. So, and now apparently Saskatchewan and BC are talking about it. So we thought it would be 4 years, and it may well be 4 years before we get it back to where we wanted it. But I'll tell you, it's a long way from the Hamilton Steelhawks and Dundas Real McCoys being canceled out because of the pandemic and almost the ruination of this level of hockey. So it's going to come back. We're going to invite AAA teams. If they don't have a AAA league to compete and challenge for it, they just have to go through the process of beating teams. They can't host, but they can challenge. And that'll change. They'll all want to become AAA so that they can host. So I think another year or two, we're going to be right back where we wanted. And one of the big steps for us this year was having it televised, and we were able to secure an absolute broadcasting legend in Rod Black, who did it along with Rick Vive, who played and coached for the Real McCoys, and I've watched...
He played somewhere else too, didn't he?
He played for the Leafs, I think. Oh, okay, yeah. Scored 53
but
times.
But better known for his time with the McCoys.
Better, of course, this weekend.
Yes.
Ask the fans. And so, I mean, Cable 14 did a bang-up job. I looked at the opening. Haven't seen the celebration yet, but from what I've seen, it was a far better production than what TSN did in 2014. TSN brought three cameras. I think Cable 14 had 25 cameras. I mean, they were everywhere. you know, we had a desk between. I mean, the broadcast was brilliant. I don't know if you've had a chance to see it or not, but it was exceptional. And that just takes the whole thing to another level. So we got to carry on and keep going.
All right. Don Robertson is in studio sitting beside this giant, majestic, exceptionally heavy silver goblet named Alan. Let's not talk about him for a second. Let's talk about his friend Stanley, because that's what the Leafs are trying to get to. And Don, I just look, we're just been talking about you guys, people who have finished, for the most part, finished their professional or elite hockey careers. They're guys who want to keep playing now. They're senior players. They have jobs, they have families, and yet they go out there and they're willing to do anything to win this. Meanwhile, you got the Leafs. And I may be misreading this. I may not be seeing things right, but I don't think so. The difference in intensity and sacrifice and commitment and, like, look, it's amazing to me that this team can look as uninterested, as disinterested as they do when they play against Boston, when you would think after all the embarrassment over the years and the humiliation and the losing this group has had, they would have finally said, enough, we just go for it. Who cares? We got to win. It's amazing to me.
Well, the difference between the Toronto Maple Leafs and Dundas Real McCoys are the Dundas Real McCoy players play because they want to play and they want to win a championship.
Seems like it.
The Toronto Maple Leafs clearly play for the money. They don't get paid in the playoffs. There's nothing extra. And it shows. We played every night they did, so I haven't seen. I saw a little bit. I went to sleep to them Saturday night. I was so damn tired. But once that I did notice, though, is the Leafs about hit Boston. But you have to block shots. You have to get in the way. You have to have active sticks. You have to pay the price. You have to be prepared to take a hit to make a play.
Let me go to that for a second. I want to jump in because you said the Leafs have out-hit the Bruins, and that's fine. Ironically, Guy Boucher, who's on the Leafs bench, who's a special teams coach, has not been having a great run. But when he was with the Hamilton Bulldogs, I remember talking to him one time, and we were talking about toughness in hockey. And his answer was, my idea of toughness is not starting a fight or flying into someone. It's, are you willing to go into the corner to take a hit to make a play? The fact that the Bruins have been out-hit by the Leafs, yes, it tells me the Leafs are throwing the body. But it also tells me the Leafs are not putting themselves in position to be hit by doing those things.
Well, yeah, there's all kinds of stats, right? And it'd be interesting to see how many players won't make the play because they don't want to get hit. I mean, that would be a key ingredient. And if I was running a team at that level, I would want to look at every game and say, all right, the Radley kid bailed out on making two plays tonight because he wasn't prepared to take a hit. And there is a big difference. Like, we had they use the term heavy, and I concur with that. I mean, we had a heavy team. We had Ryan Horvath out there hitting people. We had everybody hitting people. But sometimes you need the odd guy that's pretty mean, too, that's prepared to give you a little shot, you know, between the pants and the shoulder pads and crack a rib, and because you got to pay a price. And I still don't think the Leafs have any more than two or three guys that are prepared to pay that ultimate price. The guys that it sounds like that are playing that way more than the other ones are guys that have contracts up.
Or who are on the fourth line.
Bertuzzi, Domi. Like, they need contracts next year, and they're trying to create their worth. The guys that seem to have signed great big contracts or have contracts expiring, and they'll never be renewed at that rate. Everybody has to pay a price. Everybody. Like, anybody that was, I don't want to keep lumping us in, but we just won a championship. But Bonello and Wood and Brewer are, you know, some of our highlight reel type of players, got pounded several times in the tournament to make a play. And if you won't do that, you're not going to be successful. And if the Leafs will not pay the ultimate price with their body, they might not have won the Allen Cup tournament.
So you've been on benches for a long time. You just were. Do you believe that, like, there's been a lot of talk that if this doesn't work out, if they lose tomorrow or Thursday or whenever, that Sheldon Keefe is done, that he's been given his 5 years, 6 years, whatever it is, many opportunities, just can't get over the hump, can't coach this team. Could a coach make a difference with this team? If you bring in someone like a Craig Berube, who is a can be a scary guy. Or you bring in Rod Brindamore. There's rumors that he hasn't signed yet with Carolina, so he may be a free agent. If you bring in the right coach who can terrify these players, can you terrify guys who don't have it in them into doing this, or has it just got to come from them?
Pat Burns did.
Yeah, but
bringing him back would be a real challenge.
Yeah, but Pat Burns also had Wendell Clark, and he had Doug Gilmore, and he had a bunch of guys that were willing, Mark Osborne and Peter Zezel, the guys who were willing to do that stuff. Can you, as a coach, if you simply keep the lineup you have and say, we believe in the talent, we just have to get them to play that way, can a coach scare you or compel you into playing that way?
I don't know if they can anymore. Willie Nylander is going to make $10 million for the next 45 years or whatever his contract is. I don't think you can make Willie take a hit to make a play because he has guaranteed income. And I think a coach could make a difference here. I think I'm really showing my age, Pat Quinn and Pat Burns have both passed on now. But guys like that, I think people would believe in, and if they've had some success, the last thing I would bring in now is try and reinvent the wheel and bring in a guy that is an up-and-comer and could be a great coach. You've got to bring in John Cooper. I wouldn't bring Keenan in. I wouldn't bring Tortorella in.
Well, see, Tortorella would be fascinating. Now, he's got a contract, and I know that a lot of people are not fans of him or his style, but you know that he finds somebody on the roster with every team and makes them the guy that he's going to pick up. It'd be fascinating if he was, because Mitch Marner has been in the crosshairs here. If suddenly John Tortorella was the Leafs coach and Mitch Marner was the guy getting sat during games, or again, would that change anything, or would that just make Mitch Marner sign a contract with someone else next year?
He'd go somewhere else. Tortorella, Philadelphia named a captain, started the year. He sat him out.
Yeah, I know.
Like, he doesn't give a damn who you are if you're not doing what he wants you to or the other guys. And see, what happens is, Scott, when you get a hockey team and you get a guy that's kind of vocal in the room about you have to pay the price, you have to pay the price. We had one in 1987 with the Moscamanos that won an Allen Cup. And a couple guys come up and says, I'm going to drop him. If he doesn't stop talking about paying a price, he hasn't been hit all year. And he's talking about, and so you can't do that. You can't try and lead and then not do the job. But guys like Tortorella, okay, use Tortorella or John Cooper. You get the Berube. There's a lot of guys out there that they come in with the success they've got. They can threaten those guys.
Well, so I was going to say that like Berube or Rod Brindamore, using those two examples, or even Joel Quenneville, if, you know, that's a tricky one based on why he's out of hockey. But, you know, those guys, they all have a crooked nose from their time in hockey, and they've paid that price. And so they would presumably come with credentials and credibility. But then I'm remembering Sheldon Keefe kind of played that way too as an NHLer. So,
but he hasn't had any success coaching.
No. Like
Quenneville's won two cups.
Yep.
Mark Crawford has won a cup, who's still kicking around. The only threat I think you've got...
Berube just won one with St. Louis.
Yeah. The only hammer that a coach now has is to sit a guy out because they don't want to be embarrassed. Now, can you imagine if somebody come in next year and Marner isn't playing the way the coach wants him to play or for whatever the reason, and he sat him out one weekend, two games? Like, they don't want to be embarrassed. I mean, they're all millionaires.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't motivate them with money, and you can't threaten most of them with trading because Dubas gave them all no trade contracts. So the only thing you can do is embarrass them, and that might work. Sheldon Keefe is in a corner, and he can't do that now. First of all, it's playoffs. But he can't play that card now. A new guy probably can, and I think it's going to – if they don't win two rounds – Sheldon Keith will be an assistant coach in Dundas next year if he doesn't get picked up somewhere else. And I think you're going to see the end of the Shanny plan. I think Brendan Shanahan, because Keith Pelly wants to win. Keith Pelly's a businessman. Keith Pelly, who's now the president of MLSE, in his contract, the general managers of all of the teams can't go to the board for permission for anything. They have to come to him. They can't do an end run on the president. So the buck stops with him, and he wants to win, which is wonderful. He also understands the value of the Toronto Maple Leafs going to the Stanley Cup Finals. I talked to a president of an NHL team one year, and I said, if you guys are out, who do you cheer for? The Canadian team. He said, Toronto. I said, why? He said, they're good for business. If the Toronto Maple Leafs win the Stanley Cup, it will be good for business for all Canadian teams in the NHL because the awareness level goes up so high.
All right, one more on this one. If you were the Leafs then, if you were Keith Pelley, do you look at this and say, okay, if they don't win, yeah, Sheldon Keefe is gone and Brendan Shanahan may be gone, but we're going to be okay for one more year to keep these guys together, the players, trusting that whoever we bring in is going to be able to do exactly what you said, sit Marner or sit Nylander or sit whoever and eventually get the point across. We are convinced that we could get these guys to play that way and win. Or do you have to just get rid of them?
I think the way the contracts are structured, you're going to have to go another year with them. I think Tavares has another year at 75 million.
They all have no trade now.
$75 million.
You could squeeze like a guy like Marner, presumably.
His contract's up. He's got one more year.
Presumably, you could say to him, we are going to bench you all next year unless you give us three teams that you'll be willing to be traded to or something. I mean, you could try.
He may want out the way things are going with him.
That too. And there's one other thing, too, is that if you sign with your existing team, you can sign an eight-year deal. If you sign as a free agent, you can only sign for seven. Maybe you argue, we'll trade you somewhere you want to go, and you can then sign your extension with them, you know, or sign with us, and then we trade you whatever.
Well, the interesting thing is, though, I mean, the way he's producing now and the issues, alleged issues he's having, his value has not gone up. But the challenge is if you trade one of those guys and it comes back to haunt you
and you know it will.
Bite you.
You know it will.
Like if Marner goes to Boston, next year Boston win the Stanley Cup, you know that's what's going to happen.
And he'll lead the team in scoring and probably win Conn Smythe, and then you'll forever look like a doofus for doing that.
Yeah.
And you know that would happen. Guaranteed that would happen. It's you almost have to make sure you trade him to Utah or, you know, somewhere where there's no chance that this is going to turn out. But he's never going to accept a trade there.
Was it John Kervis that Toronto got?
Tom Kervis.
From New Jersey for...
The first round draft pick
Scott,
that became Scott Niedermeyer.
Scott Niedermeyer.
Yep. Yeah.
How's that one going?
Still stings. Don... You know, I got to say this for the Blue Jays. I was down there on the weekend to see Shohei Ohtani. And you talk about, we're talking about guys who perform and everything. As everybody in the crowd is booing him for choosing LA over Toronto, as they're booing him on the, I think, third pitch, he hits one into the bleachers. And
pretty good way to shut him up.
It's just like rising to the occasion. Okay, but here's the thing that the stadium, what they've done with the stadium to rebuild it looks amazing. Rogers Center looks better than it ever has before. They've done a terrific job on the renovation. It's truly a lovely ballpark now, which you could never say before about Rogers Center. Before, it was a ballpark.
Yep.
It's a beautiful ballpark now. But at the end of last year, the beginning of this year, Ross Atkins, the general manager of the team, when they didn't make a lot of changes, one of his comments was, we will make internal corrections, internal improvements. They have made, apparently, there's nothing different. They still can't hit. And it just seems to me that when you're talking about professional athletes at that level, at the highest level of any sport, expecting that guys or women are going to make chasmic improvements from one year to the next. There's going to be tweaks. A guy's going to go from hitting 280 to 315 maybe in a great year, or going from hitting 30 homers to 40 homers in a great year. And very rarely, every once in a while, somebody goes berserk and has this enormous... But you can't trust that everybody on your team is going to improve by 10 or 15% in a year, can you? That's unrealistic.
Well, it's stupid.
It's unrealistic.
Yep. You need, based on their theory, every one of the Blue Jays to have a career year.
Significant improvement.
Sure. But that's how you make internal progress. Vladdy didn't have a fabulous year last year.
Nope.
He's not like he's knocking the lights off or ripping the leather off the ball this year. I think they counted on him, Bichette doing far better. Springer's doing okay, but Springer's almost as old as I am, right? He's kind of like Tavares.
If I put him on the other side of you with the Allen Cup on one side, I don't know if I could tell which one is older.
The Allen Cup's pretty shiny.
So is his head.
Good point. And you're mocking him.
Hey, us bald guys can make fun of other bald guys.
Okay, fair enough. It's like me laughing at chubby guys. It's all right to do it. Yeah, I think they hope. And I learned a long time ago in building hockey teams, hope is an absolute terrible strategy. Hope does not work. You need guys that can do the job. And you can't count on guys hoping that he will have the playoff series of his life. And if he does things that he's never done before in his life, nobody ever thought he could do, then maybe we can win. You're not winning with that approach.
I think maybe you could. So you talked earlier about, you know, your team, you lost the guy who's been your goalie for the last Allen Cups. You bring in another guy. You're hoping that he can hold the fort. He did. He did better than that. He won MVP of the tournament. But that's one guy. What the Blue Jays are essentially hoping is that every guy can be as good as your one player you were relying on could be. And even with your one, now, again, your goalie was great. And I don't know if the guys at the beginning of the tournament thought, oh, we better play more defensively to help him out because we're not really sure, but then they got confidence. You can't insulate all nine guys on the dot. You can insulate one person. Yep. You can help one person. But if everybody needs insulation, nobody's insulated.
We did play better defensively because we didn't have Mike Mullen in net, and it turned out that DeMello was more than capable. But you're right.
You're not sure.
Yeah, that's right. And defense wins. I mean, we gave up 5 goals in 4 games. It's 7 goals. It's a bad way to do it, and then they had no plan B. You know, when they didn't get the stud player, they had no plan B. They had a gazillion dollars. We've talked about that before. You don't have a gazillion to bring in 2 other guys because he was going to bring in so much merchandise, so many fans. You could make a case for paying him $50 million a year, although I think he's making $3 million this year. I don't know how the bean counters figure that out in L.A., but, you know, when he's getting endorsements of $33 million a year, really what he makes to play baseball for you doesn't mean anything. But they had no plan B, and plan B is we'll internally get better. Well, we can see how that's going to work for them.
Yeah, it's I love that line you just said. What did you say about hope? Hope is a terrible
strategy.
Yeah, no, it is. Hope is a terrible strategy, but that's what they were apparently going on. Same batting coach, same manager, most of the same guys. And right now, I mean, things could turn around, but right now they are not playing very well. And certainly if the Dodgers are the gold standard in Major League Baseball right now, and I don't know if they are, but they are among them.
They're pretty good.
They're among the best teams. You're nowhere close. They won that one game on Sunday because you had a dominant pitching performance. But if that's what you got to rely on to win every game.
Well, they don't have the staff to have dominant pitching performances every night. Their pitching staff is far better than their hitting.
Yeah, but and you can, you know, they could get 2 weeks in a row of dominant pitching performances. They have that kind of thing. But there's no way you can expect 6 straight months your pitching is going to be good enough to compensate for an absolute inability to hit.
Yeah,
Vladdy's not realistic.
Vladdy and those guys are going to have to hit. They're going to have to get hot, and they can. But can they get hot and stay hot, right? You can't just get hot for a month. I mean, that really helps. But you need consistency. You need them to see the ball. You need to make solid contact. It'll find, you know, when you're hitting everything that comes at you, some of them are going to find holes. But if you're not, and now you get guys saying, well, I'm going to clean this thing up. I'll fix the problem. I'll hit a couple home runs tonight. Now they're swinging for the fences instead of for averages, and it won't work.
Don Robertson sitting here in studio next to the Allen Cup that he won Dundas Real McCoys 2 times back-to-back. And you were telling me somebody who – there were a bunch of people who were at the game yesterday, obviously, or Saturday. But who was at the game on Saturday?
David Ayers.
The Zamboni driver.
The Zamboni driver that played for Carolina when they beat the Leafs.
Was there at the game.
Yep. Sent me a message, wanted to come. I said, yep, I'll give you one of my 2 tickets.
Well, I looked. I heard he might be. I didn't see him. So a
bunch of Shoresy guys were there, too.
That's right. Well, one of your guys is in Shoresy, the new season.
What 2 of them, Brad Bonello and Cam Fergus.
Cam Fergus, son of former NHLer Tom Fergus.
His uncle. Who was at the game?
Okay, yes, I saw him there. All right. Don, congratulations. Thanks for being here. Thanks for bringing the cup in.
Thanks, Scott.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.